With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. England, of course, blazing a trail in the T20 World Cup. Their last match of the group stages is on Saturday against South Africa. But England's performances in the World T20 have suddenly been totally eclipsed by the Azim Rafiq racism story that's engulfed Yorkshire County Cricket Club. And in fact, we did a podcast on this yesterday, and we've had to throw that one away because already new events have come to light, new decisions have been made, chairmen have resigned and so on. So we're going to do a new take on this whole issue. And it's interesting that the new Cricketer magazine is out today, which has on its cover headline, Crisis in the Corridors. And actually, we thought originally that was just going to refer to some problems in the ECB running the game, various controversies that have surrounded them over the last few months, including the departure of Ian Watmore, the chairman, and other things. But in fact, this headline has proved to be remarkably prescient, given what's happened in the last 24 hours or so, with the chairman of Yorkshire, Roger Hutton, resigning over the Azim Rafiq allegations and issue, and other members of the Yorkshire board might do the same in due course. The events are sort of getting almost out of control. But we have quite a lot of material in the Cricketer magazine covering this sort of area, and two journalists in particular are very hot on these particular subjects. So Hugh Turberville has written some interesting material about the current state of play at the ECB and the departure of Ian Watmore. But we should get straight to the story about Azim Rafiq, which is unfolding as we speak. And the man who's really been at this from the start and really covering it with great detail is George De Bell. George, thanks for joining us. I know you've written a column in The Cricketer about this, which, of course, in a way is almost out of date now. The problem with running a monthly magazine is you have to go to press about a week before, or you write it about a week before it goes to press. So your column from a week ago will seem like kind of ancient history in a way. But just give us a little sense initially. How did you first get involved in the Azim Rafiq case?
Oh, that's a good question. James Butler had interviewed him, who does James Butler does
the Cricket Badger podcast.
That's right, the Cricket Badger podcast. And oddly, I had saved James Butler from drowning once in the Caribbean. So James owes me. And he said, I need you to talk to Azim Rafiq. He had done a podcast with him, and Azim had said some strong things in it, but it hadn't really gained any traction. And so he wanted me to write about it on Crick Info. And I actually ignored him for a week. I had done several similar pieces and I had found them quite draining for various reasons. And I was a little bit reluctant to get dragged into another one at that stage, which I'm embarrassed to admit now. And also, I was just really busy with other work. Anyway, I phoned Azeem one evening. I think I was meant to be covering England v Pakistan. I was at Old Trafford. And almost immediately, I realised the extent of the problem. I was gripped to his story, and also the fact that he sounded kind of like a broken man, really. He had really been through it, and he sounded desperate, and he sounded as if he needed help. So I felt that I had a responsibility to tell his story. And I started to check it out as well. And it was even worse than he was saying at times. I mean, a lot of people who had played with him were very open about the experiences. They had a lot of regret. They had phoned him and apologized and stuff. And I don't know, we've worked together for well over a year now and have spoken many times a day, almost every day. And it's become, you know, a very good relationship. And it's been, you know, my privilege to tell his story. And hopefully his story has cut through and maybe will make a difference, because I think most right-minded people are horrified by what he went through. And they want to ensure that other people don't go through it.
Has it, the story, sort of gained greater momentum than you expected? And impact in a way?
Well, going way back, yes. I mean, if you were asking over a year ago, yes. The aim for a few weeks has been to have the political involvement. And I was hoping that DCMS would get involved. I've been pushing for that for a little while, because nothing else was making any difference. You know, it seemed the game was very reluctant to listen. PCA hadn't listened. Yorkshire certainly hadn't listened. And the ECB were, you know, saying all the right things, but not doing anything. So, and then once it moved, which was last Monday, which was the day, I think, that we did the piece about the player who'd used the P word and it had been dismissed as banter, that seemed to really cut through, to be honest, in a way that, yeah, I wasn't particularly expecting. And then from then, things moved very fast. But I've had an aim for a couple of months that something like this would happen. But yeah, once we reached tipping point, you know, things have fallen very, very quickly, and will continue to for a few weeks, I think.
Clearly, the emphasis of this, the core of this, is racial bullying and so on, that Azeem Rafiq and allegedly other Asian-born or Asian ethnic-oriented players suffered. But also, is it a parallel case that Azeem Rafiq is also seeking compensation for his dismissal from Yorkshire?
So at the time that case started, the employment tribunal started, Azeem was making no progress with his attempts to complain through the game's protocols. So he tried a different strand, yeah. And that is ongoing. That was on legal advice. I don't think he's massively committed to that process, to be honest. And he's had several options to turn it down. I can absolutely... He has no win, no fee solicitors, okay? Which is completely reasonable. You know, they've got to earn a living. And they are going to need to be paid at some stage. So I would say that they are largely running the employment side of things. And Azeem is... He's not motivated by money at all. I actually have urged him to settle between, you know, if I'm honest, and, you know, ensure that life is a bit more comfortable for his family. But he has no interest in that at all. He is only motivated, whatever anyone thinks, I promise you, he's only motivated by trying to ensure that life is better for his children, to ensure that they are judged on merit and not by the colour of their skin.
And what's his state of mind at the moment?
Look, he's okay. He's lost a child. Yeah, It's a big deal. He's lost a child. He's lost a career, and he's had a lot of abuse. He's had a lot of frustration. So, you know, he's going through a period of mourning, and I think I've referred to him previously as broken, and that's not fair. He's cracked for sure, and he's hurt, but he's strong. I mean, that's probably the definition of strength, isn't it? When you don't feel you can go on, when you feel broken and weak, and you keep going anyway. And that's what he's done. So he is determined. He's extremely bright. It's been a real pleasure to work with him in those regards. And I think he's very honourable. Now, I know that he has a past, as do I, by the way, which is, I'm sure that most of us have done things in our past of which we're not entirely proud. And I don't think it's relevant, really. The factor here is that he shouldn't have been judged on the colour of his skin, and he shouldn't have been discriminated, harassed or bullied. And he went through every hoop that was demanded of him to complain and report, and they were all ignored. So he has done us a service, I think, in highlighting lots of failings within the game. And I honestly think that the game, including Yorkshire cricket, will owe him a huge debt in years to come. I honestly think he's a bit of a hero. But, you know, I've been working with him quite closely. Maybe I'm a bit biased.
What's the truth of the fact that he and Gary Balance are, according to Balance, best mates, or were?
They're clearly not, are they? But yeah, they were friends. They were absolutely friends, and that's nice and good. I'll tell you what. About two mornings ago, maybe three, Azeem woke me up at about 6 o'clock with a phone call, and his concern was making sure that Gary Balance was going to be okay if his name came out. We hadn't produced his name at that stage. Well, I never did, actually. But, you know, there were a couple of newspapers sniffing around, and it became apparent that they were going to work it out. And he was worried to make sure that Gary had the support and help, which Azeem never had. So that's a mark of him. I mean, they definitely were friends, and that's going back probably 8 years, to be fair. But when Azeem, at that stage of Azeem's life, he was, he would enjoy going out, he would enjoy a drink. And then he decided he wanted to be, a better Muslim, for want of a better phrase. And at that stage, the differences between him and his teammates started to show. And it was basically when he stopped trying to fit in, stopped trying to be part of a culture that was never really him, that he fell out with them. While he was trying to be the typical sort of Western Yorkshire white, I guess, Leeds lad, that was seemed to be okay. And as soon as he wanted to be, I don't know, the Muslim young man, that was when there started to be friction with some of his teammates.
Mm.
I think that if there's only one takeaway from this, people have to learn that they cannot use that word.
Mm.
You don't use it. There's a million other words in our vocabularies, eh? So use those instead. I think as a white man in Britain, you just don't use the word. I'll tell you what, I had to tell a colleague in the press box within the last 4 or so years to stop using it. Now, he wasn't using it pejoratively. And I said, you can't use that word, mate.
Mm.
And he said, oh, it's just an abbreviation. To which I said, actually, well, we're here for 7 hours, you know, take the extra 0.1 of a second and, you know, go enjoy it. Say the whole word. there is no way you can get away with it. It has connotations, and to ignore that at this stage is to be antagonistic. Now, the point you make about banter in the dressing room, some things that we felt were acceptable 30 years ago are absolutely not now. Mm. And that's okay. We learn. I don't know that the people on the wrong end of the banter ever felt that it was particularly helpful or positive or uniting. I think that sounds like it would have been quite alienating. So, you know, we live and learn, but I think it would be extremely unwise for anyone to use that terminology or terminology similar to that. And the other thing is, by the way, you know, dressing rooms, maybe it would be more helpful if they're a bit more supportive.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that. And it's interesting that people like Marcus Gothic have made the point that he made the point to Nasser Hussain, interestingly, he was surprised when he came into the England dressing room that there were so many harsh comments made and you know, piss taking going on. And he said to Nasser as captain, can we kind of be a bit nicer to each other, sort of thing. And I suppose, you know, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
I mean, I think there is a line, Simon, though, isn't there, between you know, we take the piss out of each other in the press box. In fact, there's a WhatsApp group with some of my best friends from the colleagues from the press box, which is called "I'm bullied in here every day," which is something that I said in there as a joke, and they make fun of me every single day, and every single day it's funny, but they're never racist or homophobic or sexist. Mm. You can be funny without being excluding people in those ways. Mm. So I don't think we're necessarily saying, oh, the world has to be completely humorless. You just have to not be racist.
What about, you've today told the story about another player who is substantiating Azeem Rafiq's claims about Michael Vaughan's comment that there are too many of you around, kind of thing. You've substantiated that with Rana Al Naveed now. So just tell us about that.
Well, he'd always said that, to be fair. I mean, the allegation was that Michael Vaughan had said that to four people as he ran on. The Yorkshire had fielded four young Asian players in that game, I think. One of whom was Azeem, and another one was Rana. And Rana endorses Azeem's memory that he heard that. Now, you know, I wasn't there. Michael deserves a right to reply. And I would think that there is a way back here for Michael. I wonder if he might be best off reflecting with some humility on some of the things that people think he has done and said. I'm wondering whether, and saying, you know, maybe if I had my time again, I'd be a wiser man. And I personally, I would be quite open-minded towards that. I think a blanket denial at this stage, oh, I don't know, people will make up their own mind. It seems odd that two players who played with him would decide to make something up like that. But, you know, it's not the most egregious racial slur we've ever heard. It might even have been a very clumsy attempt to be a uniting thing. It might have been. I've been generous there. I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm not the judge and jury. But two of the four have endorsed what Azeem said.
And what about the other two?
Well, one of them, I think, is very keen not to. I mean, just seems to have genuinely said he didn't hear it, and that's completely fine. If they were there, I wasn't. The other one, let's see what he says. I don't think it's very... Yeah, let's
see. You can't
see.
Prejudge it at the moment, okay.
Well, no, I mean, we have spoken.
Okay.
But, you know, people have views and memories, and also they have a choice about what they want to say in public, because not everyone wants to be subjected to the abuse that Azeem has. I mean, Azeem this morning had someone phone his suppliers. He's got a fish and chip shop, and try, you know, he's had to phone the police this week because people were at his mum's door and stuff. He's had to put up with a whole load of rubbish. And I absolutely get, if I was a Yorkshire colleague, if I was one of that group of four, I can see that you'd be looking at what Azeem's gone through and thinking, do you know what? I don't fancy that.
Do you think it's endemic in the game, this? Now, I mean, Yorkshire obviously are at the bearing the brunt of the storm at the moment. I mean, do you think it's rife amongst the game still?
I don't know about rife. I mean, I don't know how you would define that. I think we have an inclusion problem. Yeah. I think we have a diversity problem. But we do in society, whether that's always about race or about class or about money, I don't know. And I don't know where that begins and starts. You know, if it's a Venn diagram, no doubt they cross over. You know, we make all sorts of mistakes in the game. One of the key ones is that as a young player joining a county system, you were asked to pay for coaching and kit. Just about everywhere. So if you're a talented young person, you have to pay 300 quid or so to be in the county system. Well, straight away, you're excluding vast sections of society. Mm. Not necessarily non-white, but just vast sections of society. You know, the figures would suggest that recreational level, there's a lot of Asian people playing cricket in the UK. And figures would suggest that when we get to professional level, that isn't happening. I think the disparity is 35% to 3%.
Yeah.
We've got to look at that. There are reasons. Racism is too broad a word, probably. But, you know, institutional racism, I do believe in that. Do I think it's endemic? I think we've got a problem. Do I think it's worse at Yorkshire? Oh, God, yeah. I mean, Honestly, I'm dealing with this stuff every day in the last 18 months. And nearly every club that you talk to, which may have issues, seems very keen to engage, listen, change, be better. Yorkshire, I've just found blanket denials. They do not accept there's a problem. And they seem absolutely insistent that they don't need to change. Now, that is a problem in itself. I mean, clearly, the first step towards progress is to acknowledge you have a problem.
So what happens now? We've seen Roger Hutton depart, resign, even though he kind of landed in this in the middle when it was going on. And he obviously tried to reform the board as much as he could. What happens next? There is this hearing at the DCMS in 10 days' time or so. What happens before that, do you think?
Well, Lord Patel will be appointed as chair, which is an interesting choice because he is an Asian man. He was brought up in Bradford, and he experienced racism firsthand, both on the streets of Bradford and playing league cricket in Bradford. And I've just spoken to him, funnily enough. It's why I'm late for this. And he told me he learned to run when skinhead gangs were chasing him. So, you know, the P word is not banter to him. He has lived it, he has breathed it. He's an interesting choice, though, because he remains close to Colin Graves. I think I'm right in saying that he wouldn't have been able to be appointed without Graves's board advisors, the Graves trustees allowing him. I think they still have a veto on the Yorkshire board. So I think he's got a very difficult decision because at the moment, the executive directors on that board are, and I'm talking about, let's be clear, Martin Moxon and Mark Arthur, are the ones about whom many of the complaints have been made. And they seem to have been very reluctant to release a report, which is not very flattering about their behaviour. And they seem very reluctant to admit they've made any mistakes or need to change. So I think he's going to need to sack them. I can't really see any other way for Yorkshire to go forward. Now, that's very difficult. And then you end up with maybe employment tribunals there as well. But that looks like the what's going to happen next. And the DCMS hearing was very interesting. I very much hope that Roger Hutton goes, because I felt Roger Hutton was a well-meaning man who got bogged down and that he could blow this wide open with his testimony. So I hope that he goes. I hope Azeem goes. And, you know, Mark Arthur and Martin Moxon can go and defend themselves as well. That's absolutely fair.
Let's move on. So I'm sure you'll keep us abreast of developments there. I know you're going to that meeting next week or the week after, and your columns in the Cricketer reflect that. Terbs, your columns also sort of cover some kind of mini crises in English cricket, but on a more administrative level. You did an interview with Tim Lamb, didn't you, in this current issue, 25 years on from the formation of the ECB out of the TCCB. What were the kind of main things that you took out from the Tim Lamb interview?
So we saw Tim at the cricket writers lunch and put to him that, you know, he'd make a nice interview for the Cricketer. And then we realised that the ECB was coming up for 25th birthday on January the 1st. And he was the chief exec for the first 7 years of it. And so we'd done a 5-page interview over quite a nice lunch at the sports bar in Victoria. And he gave me chapter and verse about why the ECB was created, TCCB not fit for purpose and all that, MCC gradually losing some of its sort of administrative power. All very interesting, and we dealt with various things that happened during his tenure, including the 2003 World Cup, trying to persuade the England team to play in Zimbabwe, the new Labour government saying that they shouldn't play, and that was all very awkward. Tim was in the middle, and he maintains to this day that England should have sort of fulfilled their contractual obligations, so that was a difficult period. He's very, very interesting on the Stanford saga, Stanford scandal, if you like. He doesn't name the ECB chairman and chief executive at the time, who were, of course, Giles Clark and David Collier, but he says they were incredibly lucky to keep their jobs after such a shameful episode. There was some interesting stuff about T20, it came in during his tenure, and he was delighted it did. He saw that as a major achievement. But even at the time, he was worried that the counties would over-egg it. And of course, they probably have now. We've got a new tournament. He's got some concerns about the 100. He calls it a curate's egg. Says, you know, he quite enjoyed it, quite enjoyed watching it. But I think he shares a lot of the misgivings that a lot of us have, including George and me and others, that, you know, there's too many tournaments. David Gower, there's too many tournaments. You know, it would be okay if July was 2 months long, but you know, five tournaments, is it trying to fit it into four, into a gap for four, is impossible. So he's got major misgivings about that.
Of course, he presided over, he was in office when the ECB sold their TV rights to Sky.
Well, he was actually on his way out. He was serving his notice period, and he wasn't involved in the negotiations. Giles Clark, who wasn't chairman yet, but was in charge of the TV negotiations, kept Tim abreast of all developments, which Tim chuckled about. I think Tim thinks that he was trying to sort of keep him in the tent there so that he wouldn't go out and give damning exit interviews about the TV rights. But Tim says he's just thoroughly relieved it didn't happen on his watch. He didn't say anything publicly recently, and Watmore did. I mean, you know, the Watmore Lamb axis were involved with the negotiations with the then Culture Secretary Chris Smith getting Test cricket rights off the Crown Jewels, list of Crown Jewels. And I think the thing was, BBC did pay a pittance for it up to 99. Mm. I mean, I think Tim initially said something like £1.6 million a year, but I think he retracted that and said that wasn't right. But when you consider Channel 4 paid 160 million from 99 onwards, clearly the BBC were paying nothing like that. So they defend their decision to get the cricket off the Crown Jewels because it gave them negotiating value. I mean, I've got misgivings about it because it clearly did open the door then for Sky to get the monopoly, because in 2006, Channel 4 offered half the money, according to Tim. And BBC weren't interested, ITV have never been interested. So clearly cricket had a conundrum then. You know, we need Sky and we need their Sky money. They were backed into a corner, really. So yeah, I'm not gonna let Tim off that one completely, but yeah, he said he was relieved that it didn't happen under his watch.
What does he see as the kind of state of the organization of the game now?
Well, he's very, very concerned about the independent board and the lack of cricket expertise on there. There's no first-class county representatives on it. There's minor counties. There's women's cricket, but there's no first-class representation on there. So I think that might swing back now. And Barry O'Brien, former ex-Glamorgan chairman, has now stepped in as interim chairman to replace Ian Watmore. And Tim thinks that's kind of, and I do as well, that the axis of the tectonic plate shifting slightly, that the counties are getting more of a voice again, insisting they have more of a voice again.
I mean, that's a good point to bring George back in, because in a way, you know, you are, both of you have argued against the 100, and you're also talking about, and I agree with you on this, by the way, that selling the whole rights to Sky was a mistake, and that you need to balance revenue and reach, and that deal didn't do that. But at the same time, all the counties, or most of the counties, lose money. So what is the solution if you don't maximize broadcast rights and do new tournaments like the 100, which draw more money out of the broadcasters? How do you enable county cricket to survive, George?
Well, do they lose money? Depends how you judge it. The broadcast deal pays, it largely is reflective of the test team, isn't it? And it's quite hard to pick a test team if you don't have a first-class domestic competition. So you're actually, you know, so it depends how you judge it. You know, the counties are contributing to that test team, so therefore they're contributing to the broadcast deal. So it's not quite as simple as, you know, they don't make any money. It's like saying that education doesn't pay its own way, or the NHS or something. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I don't think the 100 makes a profit. I think we've talked about this before, Simon. Just because something brings in more money, you know, just because turnover increases doesn't mean that revenue increases. And that's the situation we've seen at the moment, not least because costs are insane. But, you know, just because I don't agree with the basic issue with the 100, I don't, doesn't mean that everything about it's bad by any means. And I enjoy the cricket, certainly. I also think it's valuable that it's on free to air. And that's a real, you know, progression, I suppose. Having said that, I mean, it feels like I got mugged once in Birmingham and I had a very bad mobile phone and they let me keep it. And ridiculously, at the end of the episode, I said, thanks very much. And it kind of feels like that with the ECB, that they're the ones who have put cricket behind a paywall for 20 years or whatever it's been. And now we're saying, oh, thanks for letting me go with my crappy mobile phone. You know, there are lots of different ways this could be done. There's too much cricket. Cricket doesn't work in Windows. I mean, I think that's one of the things we've learned this year. If you want to change one thing, and I would complain about any cricket that was in a window, not whether it was the 100 or whatever. You are prioritising one format when you play in a window. And at the moment, the 100 has the prime weeks of summer, and that means we're compromising the chance.
So what you mean, you would argue for spreading, well, obviously having county cricket, championship cricket throughout the year, which I would also agree with. But you like the idea of tournaments being intermingled with each other?
Up to a point. Certainly the Blast. You see, I wouldn't have the 100. I'd have had a T20 knockout, FA Cup style, incorporating minor counties, or sorry, national counties. And I think that could have worked, and I'd have given it to free-to-air TV, for example. You see, when we talk about TV companies not being interested, it depends where you start. If you're talking about the day that the bid comes in, well, maybe that's so. But what you have to do as an executive like Tom Harrison is woo companies for years beforehand and ensure that they are interested, ensure that you have a product that they like. And one of the myths about the 100 is that it was bought in to please the TV broadcasters. And of course it wasn't. They bought a T20 tournament, which you have to keep reminding people, don't you? But yes, I would say that T20 doesn't want to start probably until the end of May, and then it could run on that sort of Friday night or Friday 6 o'clock sort of schedule as much as possible with some local variants. We know that it sells very well in London on Thursdays. And yes, I would try and play championship more in throughout the season. And that doesn't mean you don't play in April. You would. I wouldn't have the 100. You know, one of my issues with the 100, when I want to go over old ground, is that it's going to reduce the number of counties by stealth. Lots of people think that's a good idea, which is reasonable. I just don't.
What it all says, of course, is that being a cricket administrator is a tough job. It's a tough gig. Terbs, the sudden resignation of Ian Watmore, the chairman of the ECB, much earlier than expected departure, sort of almost underlines that in a way, doesn't it? Just give us a bit of context on what happened there.
Nice guy, diplomat, civil servant. John Etheridge tweeted, didn't he? The guy, the cricket correspondent at The Sun, tweeted that he bit off more than he can chew, probably. You know, it was going to be a two-day sort of gig hosting the Lord's Box. But he's had enormous things to contend with, hasn't he? Like whether the Ashes was going to take place or not, the cancellation of the Pakistan tour, various other things. And, you know, it was too much for him, but perhaps too much for anyone. It came to a head at the meeting of the first class counties at the Bob Willis Trophy final, when apparently reports vary from it being a bad meeting to a shambolic meeting. What they were trying to do was find some consensus about whether to play conferences or two divisions next summer, and they couldn't reach agreement. And I think one county chief told me that if he hadn't lost the counties going into the meeting, he certainly had by the end of it. In my article, I've examined where the blame lies, where the lines of demarcation run between the responsibilities of a chairman and the responsibilities of a chief executive. And I speculate that Watmore was the fall guy. Tom Harrison, I'm sure, will have some views on that. But, you know, Watmore's gone, Harrison bats on. But the issues remain.
Yeah, why did Tom Harrison not take any responsibility for that? Why does he not justify himself? Why does he not make himself accountable to the media? I think he had been seen in public in the last 12 months as often as the Loch Ness Monster. It's very odd that the chair would take responsibility for a decision like that. What do the executive do? They're terrifically well paid.
Well, the chairman is there to coax and advise. And this is all in my Tim Lamb piece. Tim Lamb says what a chairman is meant to do and what a chief executive is meant to do. And the chairman is there to sort of advise and train the chief exec and sort of prime him. But it's the chief exec carrying out the actual actions.
The functions, yeah. The chair is there to actually sack the chief exec when necessary.
I mean, Tom Harrison, he did face up to the public about the cancellation of the Old Trafford test, and his reasons for why it was cancelled didn't really wash with the public, did they?
No, but of course it wasn't really his decision. I mean, it was India's decision. I mean, he was in he wasn't going to get the same sort of criticism for that, but they haven't taken any responsibility, really. The executive haven't taken any responsibility for the Pakistan decision. They haven't taken any responsibility for the fact that they failed to get a grip on the race crisis, which seems to be besetting the sport. I mean, you know, lots of... I don't think it's betraying any confidences here. The first day of that first piece, Tom Harrison asked for Azeem's number and phoned him. And he said, "This is on me, Azeem. I will sort this out. This is my responsibility." Well, what's happened? It's 18 months ago, almost 15, 16 months ago. And so many cricketers have told me they've had that conversation, you know, with Tom personally, but he's promised, he's looked them in the eye and he's very convincing. "I'll sort this out. I'll get this done." What's happened? Nothing.
Well, that's interesting. Thanks for the insight there from both of you. Just one final thing before we get on to sort of more positive stories is the thing that Malcolm Conn, the now chief correspondent of the Sydney Morning Herald, very kind of trenchant cricket writer who has also worked in administration, working for the board and so on in Australia. And he's come out and said in our feature in The Cricketer that Joe Root had to be persuaded by a Queensland minister to come to Australia for the Ashes. Give us a bit of detail on that, Terbs.
Yeah, so according to Malcolm, who was the press officer of Australia and is now a sort of very bullish newspaper man, isn't he? Root wasn't persuaded fully to come by cricket administrators, the Australian Cricket Australia. And it needed the intervention of a Queensland government bureaucrat to give him the assurances that he needed. And Malcolm says this is a sort of an indication again of the crisis in confidence besetting cricket administration. So it was an interesting angle. And we spoke to Joe Root at a press conference this week, and he seems sufficiently happy now that families are going out there. Some families going out now, some families going out at Christmas. And he seems happy now. But apparently it was a bureaucrat stepping in. Sir Humphrey Appleby stepped in.
Well, it's a good little story. And Malcolm Conn certainly puts a perspective on the Australian Cricket Board as well, Cricket Australia, that they're beset with as many problems as the England Cricket Board. So it certainly is a mug's game being a cricket administrator, I'd say. And we're lucky that we're journalists and we haven't got as much responsibility as them in a way. Though, of course, I mean, we can have our own impact. And I hope that as a result of George, your particular activities on this Azeem Rafiq case, that we get a satisfactory conclusion and some action is taken.
Tim Lamb told me a great quote from John Major, though. Apparently John Major said to him, "I don't envy you, Tim. It seems there are more politics in cricket than there are in politics."
It was a great line, that, which is very prominent in the current issue of the magazine. The Cricketer magazine can be subscribed to by going to thecricketer.com/subscribe, and all these stories and more can be read in there. So subscribe immediately. So that puts the administration of domestic cricket into some kind of context. Obviously a tricky job. In a way, an even trickier job is running the international game. The International Cricket Council, of course, have that responsibility. And I was suggesting actually recently in an earlier magazine that there was a conflict going on between the International Cricket Council, who are trying to run the international game, and lots of domestic leagues and franchise owners who are trying to get more and more domestic T20 leagues going and more teams involved in those. And so you can see a conflict sort of happening there as the calendar gets more and more congested. But, you know, refreshingly, the newly appointed chairman of the ICC is Greg Barclay, a New Zealander, and he seems to have a much more positive outlook on the future of international cricket and the way that franchises and T20 leagues can work together with the international game. I interviewed him on Zoom a week or so ago, and the interview is in the Cricketer magazine. And I thought I'd just play a little bit of his interview, actually, talking about the future of the way that T20 and the international game can integrate, and being positive about that, and also looking at the prospects for cricket being an Olympic sport and very much using T20 to expand the game.
In my personal view, and I think it's probably a generally accepted view, is that domestic leagues are here to stay, and given that they are the domestic leagues of individual countries, you know, those are their internal domestic competitions. I think we've just got to live with it. I personally think that it's a great opportunity for players to be able to earn a bit of money outside of their own home, boards and arrangements, to get those experiences playing in places like the Windies and India and whatever. I think it's a huge opportunity, both financially and from a playing point of view, and it's great for the fans, quite clearly, as well. So and anything that gets people involved in cricket and watching cricket, following cricket, is got to be a good thing. So I don't feel that it's pushed us into a corner or it's something that we've got to push back against it. The challenge with it is just the calendar. It's how everything fits into that calendar, how we can fit it without compromising international cricket, the advent and growth of the women's game, as I say, the domestic competitions themselves, and taking into account player welfare and just player well-being. I mean, there's only so much that a professional athlete can actually do. So if we're not careful, something's going to break somewhere. So that's, I think, for all of us as administrators and as player managers, that's probably the massive challenge that we have moving forward. And there is, it's probably exacerbated by the fact that there's a clamour, obviously, from both boards and the player associations to generate more money out of the game, which means that we're just trying to wedge more and more stuff into an already congested calendar.
And so, you know, this is the sort of million-dollar question, isn't it? What is the solution? Is it windows for Test cricket and windows for bilateral ODI cricket? I mean, is that something on the table to try and really establish clear windows of opportunity for both international cricket and domestic cricket?
Yeah, I think that if the question is, does the ICC have a solution? No, I don't think so. I think that the ICC has a role to try to facilitate outcomes, but I mean, I'm on record as having said it. I'm using my New Zealand experience here without a doubt, and unabashedly so. I think that we've got to be really careful that we don't in any way undermine the importance of bilateral cricket. If you're New Zealand or Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, the Windies, countries that sit in behind, you know, what they call the big three, not that I hate that term, but those countries need to have an opportunity to play a regular amount of international cricket and against meaningful opponents. There's no point in Zimbabwe playing Ireland for most of their calendar. They've got to have the opportunity to play against better teams. It's the only way they'll improve. But again, it's the only way their commercial partners and more so their fans are going to continue to follow the game. And likewise, to develop pathways for players coming through. You know, they've got to be able to see decent cricket. Again, they're just not going to take the game up or participate in the game if they don't get those aspirational opportunities. So I think that the solution, whatever it might be, lies with the member countries themselves. Have got to sit down collectively, and the ICC absolutely has a role to play in this to facilitate outcomes, which is not going to in any way suppress or lessen the importance of their domestic arrangements. It certainly gives them pathways through A programs and age group arrangements, right through to, as I say, at international level for men and women to play a good standard of regular international cricket. And you know, as much as Australia, England and India are castigated around some of this, you know, it's difficult for them too, because they play more cricket than maybe not Australia. They could perhaps do a little bit better. But, you know, India play more cricket than anyone else. And, of course, everyone wants to play India because it's worth so much money. So, you know, even that is going to take some untangling. And then, as you correctly say, you start to add in the burgeoning number of leagues, and some of those leagues are like the IPL that are starting to take even more room out of the calendar. Yeah. It gets really problematic. So maybe, you know, amongst other solutions, we've got to look at you know, maybe... as I say, more sort of A-level cricket. So purely as an example, maybe some of those countries with greater playing depth will release their A-teams to play against the likes of, say, Zimbabwe and Ireland or whatever. So, you know, I still think it would be very, very good for their cricket if England A were perhaps playing against some of the lesser ranked four member countries, and certainly, you know, I think that we've got to look at what's available for maybe the next 8 or 10 countries and behind those four members, because I'm doing a lot of rambling here, but you know, I think that if the game is truly going to grow globally, then we've got to have 15 to 20 teams that are competitive at world level, you know, turning up knowing that basically four teams are going to compete in the semi-finals and finals of a men's world event is, it's just not going to spread that level of support and following for the game. So the likes of Canada and Nepal and Papua New Guinea and Oman and countries like that really need to be given the opportunity to get themselves up to the next level so they are being truly competitive.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that. And in fact, you've done a great job already sort of anointing. So I think it's 86 countries now have a T20 international label, having played T20 internationals, which is an amazing number, actually. And is that sort of one of the approaches to try and get more and more countries playing T20, which at least is sustainable in lesser known cricketing nations?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, T20, I know that it's got its detractors, particularly amongst the purists, and I absolutely get that. But, you know, it's again, in these days, what players and fans want, isn't it? And it's an easy vehicle to get the game spread much wider and to give it more opportunity to continue to grow. So, absolutely, I think that it is. And you just look at this World Cup that's unfolding at the moment, and that's 16 teams that will move into that event. As we move forward, we'll build that up to 20 teams. And, you know, again, I know it takes more days out of the calendar, but I think it's good for those countries to have that opportunity to enter those events. And I know that we make a lot more money out of, say, a 50-over event when you've only got the 8 or 10 teams. But that's just short-sighted. That's not strategically going to work for the game. We've got to open that opportunity up. And if we give a little bit away financially, I'm sure that we'll pick it up down the line. We've got a lot more growth in the global game and the following of the game.
And just to link to that, I suppose on the table, you know, in the sort of medium term, is the potential for cricket at the Olympics. Is that could that be a game changer for the game? I mean, obviously, the game is already popular in the world and, you know, 2 billion people follow it or something. But could that be something that opens it up even more? And what's the sort of ICC's latest angle on that?
getting to LA, if in fact we can, I think would be great for the game, because it's just taking the sport to an audience that's way beyond what we're able to achieve at the moment. It has the other advantages of being able to give opportunity to countries outside of those, you know, traditional handful that are strong in the game. You look at countries like Indonesia or China or places like that. If you turn it into an Olympic sport, you might really start to see some growth. But I think that really gives us an opportunity. It's around the women's game. I think that if we could, look at our female sort of strategy around females' participation in cricket combined with con games, Asian games and Olympic games, that is a really, really great vehicle to fast track the growth of the game. And finally, what it also does, because it's a perennial problem in all sports, obviously, the lesser countries are really struggling for financial resource. And if those countries that get not much money from the ICC and struggle to generate much at home, if they could suddenly tap into government funding and IOC funding, that could possibly be quite game changer for a number of them that are sitting sort of at a fledgling level, just to push them, up into the next phase. So I think it's a massive opportunity for a whole lot of reasons. And the other thing that's one probably strategic approach or answer. But the other thing is that, we've again rightly or wrongly made one of our other strategic imperative is to try to grow the game out of the US, the world's biggest sports market with a massive diaspora of Asian followers in the country. Mm. And pushing it into the Olympics in LA, I think, is a way to really give that some momentum, which is why hopefully we'll be able to get a world event into the US, which is probably a T20 World Cup co-hosted with the Windies. And I think that to give the game that sort of profile and with a push on to the Olympics could be massive for the game out of the US. So, the Olympics is very much a centrepiece of our thinking.
So, I mean, Greg Barclay talks, very positively about the future of the game. He seems encouraged by actually the spread of T20 and how it's really encouraged other nations to be involved in the international game. There are now 86 countries who are official T20 international nations. We've seen Scotland, Namibia, Oman having a key role in the World T20 recently. And his aim is to try and get more and more countries competitive at World T20 level, and then sort of leading on to the Olympics and spreading the game to places like the West Indies and the USA sharing a World T20 tournament. Of course, people will worry about the conflict with Test cricket and whether that will be minimised. I think that perhaps less countries will ultimately play Test cricket. It might get reduced from 12 to, say, 8, because sustaining Test cricket in some countries is tough with the resources you need, the playing resources and facilities and so on. But I mean, how do you see, Hugh, how do you see the conflict between T20 and Test cricket playing out?
I mean, that's not a good thing though, Simon, is it? The 12 goes down to 8. I mean, it's sad. I mean, who would stop playing Test cricket? Sri Lanka and places like that? I mean, I love cricket, Test cricket there. I mean, I'm depressed by it, if I'm honest. And you tease me about this, but I mean, it's like T20 is like Japanese knotweed, isn't it? It's just engulfing everything. It engulfed my mate's house and it's engulfing world cricket. I mean, I don't know. It's not a good thing that there's less Test cricket. It's not a good thing that we fewer countries.
Oh, isn't there perhaps too much Test cricket now? Maybe. Shouldn't it be special? I mean, we used to have 5 or 6 tests.
Seven. Anyway. Seven is too many in an English Test summer. Definitely. 5 or 6 would be great. Yeah,
And each one could be a major event.
Well, I mean, you've been arguing that in the magazine for 5-6 years, haven't you? The Ashes would be like a bit like the Ryder Cup. Sort of every 4 years, sort of slightly truncated, maybe for a very special event. I enjoyed hearing your views and it very articulately expressed. But I mean, to me, it's something that I personally will try and fight. But you can't, it's like King Canute in the tide, isn't it? You can't
turn it back.
It seems tricky, doesn't it? You can't you can't stop these things, can you? I mean, the fact is that in some countries, India, Bangladesh, West Indies, whatever, the fans want to watch T20, don't they? So I guess it's a little bit like the cinema, isn't it? You know, sort of, we want everybody to go and watch some high culture thing, Notes on a Scandal or something, but actually people want to go and watch the latest Marvel.
I mean, I suppose the way I look at it is that, and this is something that Greg Bartley actually said as well. He said, my sport in New Zealand is rugby. And, you know, every Kiwi grows up with rugby. And rugby is a sport which is really only played by a small minority of countries, largely Commonwealth countries. And it's remained fairly restricted in those countries. Cricket, with its expansion through T20, now, as I say, has 86 countries playing T20 internationals, and the potential for being an Olympic sport in 2028 in Los Angeles. So that's got to be exciting. And you know, you can see that a country like Indonesia or Malta or Croatia will never be able to play Test cricket, because obviously they don't have the facilities, but they might be able to sustain T20, a T20 competition. And there's been, you know, Gibraltar playing Spain and Portugal in a recent Tri-Nations T20 tournament. Surely that's good for the game, that it's spreading its tentacles far and wide.
Yes, if you're just a cricket fan, then yes, it is. I also can see it becoming like football, like the European Championships, like the World Cup qualifiers. Yes, I can see the counties only playing T20. They play a midweek game on a Wednesday night and a T20 game on a Saturday, like the Football League. I can see that happening, but I'm just saying I'm not happy about it, because I want Test cricket to endure, because that's my favourite format. I think it's the best format. So I can easily envisage that happening. And if you're just saying you're a cricket fan, great, but I'm a test, you know, I am a cricket fan, but I love Test cricket best.
Well, I do too, by the way. You know, I love Test cricket I don't mind if there are only eight countries playing it, if they're all really serious and it's highly
competitive. Who are the eight?
What you don't want is Ireland, you know, playing England, and it's a total mismatch. And I don't see a country like Ireland or Zimbabwe, you know, even maybe Sri Lanka becoming or being able to sustain Test cricket for very long. So it's a problem, isn't it? But anyway, this is a
very, very worrying what's happened in Sri Lanka. Yeah.
So this is an issue which obviously the ICC are grappling with. They're meeting at the moment, in fact, in Dubai. What Greg Bartley said amusingly was that he's been in the chairmanship of ICC for a year and uniquely has never actually been to a meeting because of New Zealand's strict COVID restrictions. So now they are meeting in Dubai and they're, you know, sort of wrestling with all these issues. But The news is that they will try and maintain a very good spread of Test cricket throughout the next cycle, and the World Test Championship, which obviously came to a kind of interesting conclusion in the summer with New Zealand winning it, will continue. They're going to refine the point system a bit and the scheduling, but make it a very important part of the international cricketing landscape. And so hopefully all the leading players and leading countries will aspire to win that. So that is a good thing. And I just am encouraged by generally Greg Bartley's positivity about the future of the game and the potential for its growth around the world. All that is included, all these kind of stories are included in the current issue of the Cricketer magazine, which, as I say, is out this week. So hopefully you subscribe to it by going to thecricketer.com/subscribe. And we'd just like to wish, of course, England good luck in their final T20 match on Saturday against South Africa. Hopefully they can make it a clean sweep and get straight into the semi-finals. And we'll do another podcast previewing the semi-finals early next week. So Hugh and George, thanks for your time and thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.